Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Good morning.
Good morning, Peter. And wow, we have such a wonderful program today. It's not even a star or two,
now
but
that,
a galaxy.
That assumes, of course, that you are interested in food, which is probably why you're here. And three of the modern day's greatest exponents of adventure in the kitchen just happened to be on today's program.
Yep, it's a good program. First up is, we have yet to get to this guy's restaurant. On next trip to England, we're going to go. Sat Baines, and what a wonderful book it is. Sat Baines, as I said to you, I don't know how we've managed not to meet each other in person over all these years since we sort of hang around the same places. You have this absolutely marvelous new cookbook called Too Many Chiefs, Only One Indian, which is a great title.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it's a stunner of a book. Huge. It's oversized.
It is a stunner.
It is a stunner. If you got hit over the head with it, that would be it.
My wife hit me up the side of the head because I did something wrong and I haven't recovered yet.
He's teasing. Anyhow, to explain your title, and you have a renowned restaurant, Sat Baines, a restaurant in Nottingham, and you came from a Punjabi background. You're a Sikh, and you're English-born, and your father spent a while, where was he?
He was in Penang. So when he was two, he moved to Penang for around 10, 12 years and came over to the UK when he was 14.
And you're married to a English lady from Nottingham, which is
from
why
Nottingham,
you're there.
Amanda. Yeah.
Yeah, and who's gorgeous. You have a picture of her in the book. You have a lot of influences in your background. It's very complex.
Well, I felt the book started as a project many, many years ago as an idea. And the idea was to... The title probably came 15, if not longer, years ago. Not. I was thinking of writing a book, but I thought it was a really good title. So it was originally called Too Many Cowboys, Only One Indian. And for many years, we've called our friends in the industry, we've always said chief as a term of endearment to each other. So we would say, how are you doing, chief? Good morning, chief. And we've said that a long time. And then all the chefs that have known me, including people like Heston and the chefs in the UK, when I told them about the book and the original title, which it was almost right up to the 11th hour called Too Many Cowboys, Only One Indian, he said, you can't really, you need to be calling it chief.
Yeah.
So I thought, wow. It was almost like the last minute change, and we did change it. And it fits so much better now with all of our philosophies and the identity, really, of the author. So as myself, it's synonymous with the word chief was always something we said as a friendly gesture, and it made more sense. It fitted in with the title, I think, better.
You were always sort of an abstract entity to me since I've not met you and I've not been to your restaurant, although I'm sure we'll correct that.
Well, without a doubt.
Yeah, but now it's the way you've written this book. I feel like we could be really good buddies.
Well, I used an app on the iPhone called Dragon. Uh-huh. And what I did is I physically spoke every chapter and every article that I wanted to get across, but I wanted it to be in my speech. I didn't want it to be too edited, so it was too kind of messed around with. I wanted it to be almost like the food that we serve at the restaurant here. There's a definite element of the natural style in terms of the way that we have free flow. Nothing's really set on the plate in terms of the pictures in there are actually real pictures. They're not done for art. And every picture was done in natural light. So them pictures you see in the book are actually dishes that are on the menu. And the beauty of that for me was it was all about layers and layers of honesty. So as you did a dish, it would go straight out and it would get photographed by our photographer. But then it would also be the same dish that probably would go out to the restaurant. It wasn't like we had an art... Uh-huh. editor that was really picking little tweezers and shining things up and changing the light. And that was something we were very adamant about. The reason it took 3.5 years to produce, because it was number one, self-published. And secondly, we missed some of the seasons when we had to do retakes. So you had to wait until the next year.
Right.
So if the strawberry dish didn't work and the physical picture of it wasn't right, and they went to get edited or whatever they did, then it didn't fit right, so we had to change some of the dishes, but you had to wait till next year. Because what I didn't want to do was start in, flying in Spanish strawberries or something else. I wanted it to be as true as we tried to make everything here at the restaurant.
One thing I noticed in glancing through the book is at one point you say it's interesting because you can have the same dish tomorrow and it won't look the same as it did today.
That's true. I'm a massive believer of the natural form in terms of my first passion was art. And the way we dress in the kitchen, I'm a big believer in every element of that dish should taste very good, like incredibly well. So as long as it's in proportion, it doesn't really matter where it goes on the plate, as long as the taste profile is correct.
Right.
And that's something we use a lot at the restaurant. So two dishes can be dressed simultaneously, and they're going to look similar, but they're not going to be like some chefs will say, I want the cabbage at 3 o'clock, I want the strawberries at 2 o'clock. We don't do that. We just dress as almost like it's an extension of your character. And it does take some of my boys in the kitchen a bit of time to get used to that because they're normally used to working in a lot more conformity. So they're probably used to being a bit more rigorous. But the way I look at it is that if each ingredient or each part of that dish is correct and flavored and seasoned correctly and it's the right temperature, it doesn't really matter where it falls on the plate.
Right. Now, could we say that this section that you called One Agenda is actually your philosophy of cooking?
It probably is. It was something I had a bit of a hangover on a Sunday morning, and I was looking after the restaurant in the morning on the Sunday when we have guests finishing from their night before because we have a rooms as well, 8 bedrooms. So the breakfast shift was being covered by the restaurant manager. I was doing some office work and just going to basically around 11:30 in the morning, lock up the shop and then go home. But I had this almost like this desire to write, why are we here? What is it we're doing? What's the goal? And then this thing just came out of me, and all these things I've been saying for many years. But it was actually the first time I collectively wrote it down on a piece of paper. So I knew it was something important because I then titled it in terms of the agenda, and I dated it, but I printed off 10 copies. And the 10 copies were put in the kitchen ready for Tuesday morning for every chef to have a copy of it. So it's not changed since I did it that day. I've not tweaked it since, and I just knew it was something that these are values that I think are very important to me as a chef after doing this for 23 years. I could only see it hitting a chord with other chefs similar to me that are striving to be better tomorrow than they were yesterday.
Right. You conclude with saying our goal is to be the best, so we should act like the best.
Without a doubt. If you take yourself seriously as a cook in this modern era, definitely a level of professionalism associated with that these days rather than the rock and roll from back when Marco Pierre White was on. So these days it's about discipline, it's about flavor, it's about commitment to cause. And I believe there's a great level of professionalism now, as well as a brotherhood in the industry.
Yeah, there is that brotherhood because
it's incredible.
The world
is a lot smaller, yeah.
You spend a lot of time traveling, and you have a section here about the kinds of influences you've picked up on the way, including some Asian influences, Japanese particularly.
Yeah, for me, the most purest form of tasting menu is the kaiseki. I think it's absolutely the pinnacle of produce, seasonality, and balance.
Yeah.
And if we can get close to that ideology of like the purest form that in our menus, it means we've actually been enhanced by people that have been doing this a lot better for a lot longer.
Right.
So
I'm
not afraid to borrow techniques or ideologies or things like that. But the traveling part of my career is very important. Because through the traveling, you can tell stories with your dishes. And also with traveling, I've met some incredible people. And that section of the book where it tells the bit about the stories, that was purely about trying to get a snapshot of who was around at the time of me writing that book. So there's people like Andre Chang, there's people like Ben in Australia, there's guys like in Alex Atala, there's guys in the UK that we admire and are friends. But the idea was if you were a cook or a young person that's really into this industry, you would read that and go, wow, these guys were around at this time. But there's also the added element of mischief that goes with cooking and the guys that you hang around with.
Yeah, well, I mean, I enjoyed reading through all these notes that you got back from when you asked for their comments.
Yeah.
but the one that I thought was most curious was the one from...
from Hibiscus, yes.
You guys got into a lot of trouble by the sound of it.
Is that the one with the pajama party?
Yeah, they
that was Glyn. That was Glyn Purnell from Birmingham. Yeah,
they smashed up a lamb.
Yeah, it was very messy. And I think it was a case of chefs being chefs, but also we were off duty, so we had to have a level of respect for the proprietor, who was a very good friend of ours. But it was a very, very messy weekend. But we had a blast, and we did ultimately repair the lamp.
Well, the one that I loved is because this is so much like Wiley Dufresne of WD-50.
Yeah.
He says, about 5 years ago, I was in the locker room putting on my whites to start the day. I was standing next to a new stagiaire who was also changing. He looked over at me and said excitedly, "So, what do you do around here?" I was caught off guard but replied, "I'm the chef." He said, "Oh," and that was the last time we ever spoke.
That is a brilliant story. That is so dry, just like Wiley's humour. I think it's a brilliant story. But the beauty was is that you're getting these chefs to tell stories that hopefully will excite the next generation of cooks to read that and say, you know what, these guys have got a great relationship. And every time I see these guys all over the world, it's a real good feeling, you know, that you feel part of a fraternity. And they're great people, and you've met some of the best people in the world, and they're chefs. And it just means for when the beauty is, the way I look at it, is that if I've got young boys here that are looking to move on, or young girls, and they're looking to move on, I know a lot of people through the traveling and the experiences I've had in life as a chef, it's only going to benefit them. So an example is actually quite imminent now, is one of my lads did a week at Qua with Daniel Patterson, who is a fantastic chef.
I love him, yeah.
His food is incredible. And he did a stage for a week. He then went to net at Bennu, which is one of my favourite restaurants in San Fran.
Bennu.
And then the meal he had at Bennu was mind-blowing. Once they realised that he was from Restaurant Sat Baines, which is a shock to hear this being relayed to me by my young chef, that the lady that was serving him, her boyfriend was a chef at Bennu. And she had told him, "You are joking," because he was eating as a diner for one, and that they had the book, and it's his favourite book.
Aww.
So next minute he got a little bit of VIP treatment, which was fantastic for him. And then Corey said as well that it's one of his favourite books. Aww. And consequently, in January next year, he starts his one-year placement with the Bennu.
Oh, that's terrific.
And isn't that fantastic? But
that's
just how small this world is.
Yes.
And that's just the beauty of this industry, that you can touch so many people with positivity and having an open hand rather than having a bit of a kind of shrouded shoulder to your new evolutions.
Well, you have kind of an inspiring little story yourself. Your life has been a surprise along the way, right?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt, yeah.
I love the story. If you won the Roux Scholarship and you wanted to go to Michel Brasse, and you couldn't, and then you got his third star, but then he wasn't going to take any stagiaires.
It was horrible.
So you finished
it. It was horrible because my hero from being a younger chef and reading obsessively, and I still haven't been there, and I probably haven't been there because I'm so disappointed in everything myself, but it's Michel Brasse, because he was so in tune with the land. He was so natural.
Oh, yes.
He was such a great character in terms of he's an artist. He loved the land so much, and his food was so unique to his heart. And he inspired me, and I thought, wow, this guy is something else. So I applied to do the Roux Scholarship, because at the time, they were only allowing stagiaires in France, because obviously Michel and Albert are French. And what was the beauty of that was is that because he was a two-star, I was going to ask if I had one, would it be possible to go to a two-star instead of a three? Thinking, you know, of course they'll say yes, because it's Michel Brasse. Anyway, in the meantime, he had won his third star, so I thought, this is fate. Because now I've got a chance to go to the guy that I actually entered the competition for. Now he's eligible, because he's now got three stars. And I remember the phone call like it was yesterday from Michel Roux Sr. And I was at home, and he said, "Sat, we can't send you to Michel Brasse, because he's not taking any stagiaires on this year, because he's just got his third star." I was heartbroken.
Yeah, but look where you ended up.
Oh, of course, it's always about the journey. So what I stuck in my mind, I was very upset for several days, and I spoke to my wife, but I remember an article in a magazine in the UK, and there was a piece where I always remember this, and I've still got it. It says, all these chefs dressed in white, sun shining on them, they look immaculate. And it was the Porcells, and I always remember the food, and I think it was Laurent Porcel was a sous chef for Michel Bras for many years. And I thought, you know what, if I can't go to the original chap, I'm going to go to one of his sous chefs who was very much into the terroir and all that. So I did go to Le Jardin de Sens in Montpellier, and I had a brilliant 3 months there.
And not only that, but René Redzepi was there at the same time.
So that was hilarious. I was walking in on my first day. It was a beautiful restaurant. The kitchen was just done. I think they spent £600,000 or euros, whatever it was at the time. And I thought, wow, this is incredible. And everybody was in their tall hats, and no one looked at me apart from René. And at the time, I just thought in my head, I thought, he's not French. I didn't talk to him by now. I just had this kind of inkling that he wasn't French. I spent the day in silence. I was doing the tasks that were given to me as a stagiaire, which are normally the very menial stuff until they see who you are. And then over a period of several hours later, he said in an English or Danish accent, which is very good English, hi, how are you? And I thought, wow, yes, and I thought you wasn't French. And that was it. We had a great 3 months together. Yeah. And we had some of the, for me, I had a great time out there. And I do look back at it with great fondness. And it also set me on the path, you know.
We stayed there.
I love it.
We not only dined there, we stayed there. This is many years ago.
What was interesting is this year, we all went back, and that's Andre Chang was there, head chef for many years.
Oh, wow.
He worked for them for 12 years. So we've known Andre. So me, René, and Andre, and the girls, we took all our wives with us. We had a table of six, and we had one of the best meals there. And what was ironic was that they're down to one star now, which I do not get, because it was probably as good as, if not better, than when I was there.
They were sort of siphoned off in the restaurant in Paris.
Oh, it was incredible. But we had real nostalgia. Me and René, I went to the pub. There was an Irish pub in the square in Montpellier.
Yeah.
We would go there for a Guinness after work.
Oh, funny.
And these little things, you know, they're very fond memories.
Now, Sat, most of your book is really discussing, you only do tasting menus at your restaurants.
That's right.
And you say that your recipes are, how do I put this, they're examples of evolution of these dishes.
Yes.
And you go through, you have a set pattern of the type of dish, even though it's very seasonal, the type of dish that starts and hits in the middle and closes out. The whole thing is paste.
Yeah.
And then you go through these recipes, and they are extraordinary. How reasonable, when I looked at the list of ingredients and the equipment, how many of these things could a cook make at home? Or are you mainly aiming at other chefs for this book?
Well, in fairness, it was a professional cookbook I was doing. I wasn't doing it for the home market.
Okay.
But what I did do as a security measure for my own self is I employed a home economist, and she had no equipment. She had the basics, like a home-style ice cream machine. So what we would do, as we were doing the menus, me and John, my head chef, who was a massive co-collaborator on this with me, we basically sent her an email with the ingredients and the recipe. She would then do four dishes of the recipe and send us a picture. And I couldn't believe the likeness. So she's never really worked in a professional kitchen.
Wow.
She's worked as a home economist for some TV channel or something in the past, but she's never worked in a professional capacity. And what I found is that she got very close. So that was my kind of security part of the book, that it can be done with people that are keen cooks at home.
Now, of course, you did break it down into pieces. So a dish featuring five things together, you address the preparation of each one with the same detail as if it was like a whole recipe.
That's right, yeah.
Now, because there's so many fabulous recipes. I'm not sure why ham, eggs, and peas is your signature dish, but apparently everybody likes it. But there's so many more interesting recipes. Could you just pick out a couple and run our listeners through the recipes?
Of course.
Because they love hearing about these details.
Yeah, the one I love for this just finishing now, so this early on in the summer was always the strawberry, the scallop, the strawberries, elderflower mayonnaise, and the tomato. So it's like a sauce vierge. And you finish it with a little bit of diced strawberries at the end, and you get this amazing perfume. And the beauty of that dish is that you get this lovely elderflower. And the elderflower is picked when it's at its most pungent, and we have it around the restaurant in the wild. And you pick it, and you basically do an infusion in oil. So you get a natural flavored oil, which has got no flavor. You infuse the flowers, and then cook it gently at around 40 to 60 degrees, and you let the oils and all the perfume go into the oil. You end up with this elderflower oil that you then make a mayonnaise with. So if you think of that kind of whole process, you can do that with anything. You can make it, we do a vanilla oil, a saffron oil, and then you make your mayonnaises. So that one, when you eat it, it's got this cool mayonnaise, it's got this roasted scallop, sauce vierge, it's got the coriander seeds, the wine, the extra virgin olive oil, the tomatoes, and it's finished with strawberries and basil. It's just the most beautiful start to the summer that you can imagine. And the scallops are sweet. So that's one dish that I've always loved looking back over the years, coming back to. I'm looking forward to next year already to taste it again.
Don't want to really talk about creativity, but it's something you've got in spades. You do have some quirks here. Like, what is it with blackened everything? Like your blackened eggplant.
See, this one was a case of when you char aubergine, for when you're making a puree or anything like that, you get this lovely smokiness. And the aubergine can take it. The aubergine itself is strong enough to take that flavor. So what we did is, the idea was of the scallop black, for example, was to give you visually something that looks really bitter. So black normally equates to a bit of a kind of shock, almost a bit of a kind of step back, danger almost. So, but when you ate it, everything in there was sweet. So it wouldn't register. So when you ate the actual scallop and you had the smoky aubergine puree that had actually been blackened, you end up with this lovely, sweet, roasted aubergine flavor with the elements of smoke. That really works well with that scallop dish there. And that was the bit for me. That was the contrast. Because visually you look at it and it looks almost not offensive, but it looks a little bit harsh. But the subtleties were so sweet and underlying that you ended up having something that's really fragrant. And that's what surprised people most.
I'm telling you, if anybody wants an eye-opener of a book, which is a combination memoir, education, and ideas, and creativity, and recipes, this is the one. Again, it's Sad Baines, and the title is Too Many Chiefs, Only One Indian. And, oh boy, you outdid yourself, Sad Baines.
Thank you very much.
So you're on more travels. Have good traveling.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we're going to cross paths, and I can't wait to actually meet you both.
We can make
that happen. I'm sure.
We'll be in
London in April at the.
Do you do the 50 best?
World's 50 best.
Yeah, I've been there every year.
So have we.
Well, again, we probably do know each other.
it's a big party.
We could always sneak past each other without seeing each other. Exactly. Okay. But I'll make sure we hook up this next year.
All right, and it's wonderful. Say hello to my beloved Australia when you're there.
I shall. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sad. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and I think that this one recipe would be enough to set most people into retirement. We're talking next to Dominique Ancel, the creator of the Cronut, which has entered the history notes just for the sheer volume of people and the prices that they're getting for black market Cronuts. Who ever heard of such a thing?
Black market Cronut bought at live auction, went for $5,000.
But you know,
people,
I mean,
have more money than sense.
He's really so much more than a cronut. I mean, he creates constantly, and his cookbook is a delight. Here he's going to be talking to us about how he structured this cookbook and what's in it. This is a big secret, listeners. We're not going to tell you anything about the subject today. We're talking to Dominique Ansel, and his cookbook is called The Secret Recipes. But he's hardly a secret in today's culture. How does it feel to be the world's most celebrated pastry chef?
I mean, it feels great. I'm very happy and honored that we have so many people coming for our treats every day. We try really hard to change our menu very often and to keep the pastry world excited. So I'm very honored to have a lot of people coming and try our pastries.
I told you that I've really been enjoying reading this book, and I told you before we got on the air that after all these years of doing the show, which is we're wrapping up our 11th year now, it's so wonderful to pick up books now. The cooking books that are coming in to us are intelligent for a change. And you explained what your purpose was or your mission in writing such an intelligent cookbook. Could you repeat that for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's important nowadays that people see pastry a different way. There are so many cookbooks out there. There are a lot of great cookbooks, of course. But I think that when they open my book, not only to see recipes and to follow recipes, but have inspiration, ideas, and have stories about what we did at the bakery and why, like pastry we're doing were popular. Each of our creations have a story. They all tell something. They all have some of my past, some of what I lived in the kitchen that is used to create those pastries, and they all inspire you to create or recreate something new.
People, I don't know if everybody knows your story, although with this book, with the release of this book, people will begin to realize you just didn't pop out of nowhere with a cronut. I mean, you are a thoroughly trained French tradition pastry chef with a very impressive resume. Tell us a little bit about your background. You started in the kitchen at age 15?
I started in the kitchen when I was actually 16, and my parents didn't have much money to send me to school. So very early on, I was supporting the family, and I found a job. I was 16. I worked as a chef in a restaurant, and then for about a year in a pastry kitchen. Then I decided to go to Paris and find a job by myself. I went to the big city without knowing anyone, without knowing where I was going, and I quickly found a job at Fauchon in Paris, which is one of the best pastry shop, and they have spices and jams from all over the world. A beautiful shop in the heart of Paris. I worked for them for about 8 years.
It's absolutely the most astounding, totally astounding shop. Two things that astounded me: how beautiful the things were that were in the window, and how much they cost when you went inside to buy one.
It's in the heart of Paris. It's a very expensive real estate, as you might know. But they import products and they change the menu very often. Import products from all over the world. It was a great opportunity for me to work there, and I've learned so much. And then in 2006, Daniel Boulud called me from New York and asked me if I wanted to see New York and be a pastry chef at Restaurant Daniel, which I happily accepted, and I came to New York in 2006, working for Daniel. I worked for Daniel for 6 years, six wonderful years, and in 2011, I opened my own shop in Soho.
Well, and then what put you on the map, we might as well get that out of the way.
Obviously, the cornet. We created the cornet last year, and it's just like it was just another item. We changed the menu at the bakery very often, every 6 to 8 weeks, and the cornet was just one of them. And since we opened the bakery, we've been changing the menu, creating new things, and we keep on doing the same. And I believe in creativity and innovation when it comes to pastry, and it's very important for me to stay excited and also to keep my customer excited when it comes to pastry.
Yeah, I love the way you describe what you could have done, the various things you could have done, and what you chose to do was essentially ignore the cronut, and this is with lines around the block, with hundreds of people standing in line for hours to get one of these, and a black market in them, no less. But you decided to ignore it. You didn't raise prices. You didn't do anything different. You just moved on in terms of researching and creativity. And that is wonderful to hear.
Yeah, I think it was a beautiful creation. I did not ignore it, but I think that I maintain the quality and the consistency of our product. We change it. We change the flavor every month. There's only one flavor. We have a limit of 2 per person. We have between 100 to 200 people that wait outside every morning. We have a very tiny kitchen, so the kitchen runs 24 hours. We do as much as we can to serve as many people as we can. And The most beautiful is that last year we actually auctioned off a few coconuts for charity.
Oh, did you?
And we raised over $100,000, and all the money went, 100% of the money went for charities to help to fight against hunger in New York City.
So how much did people pay at auction for a coconut?
It went up to $5,000 for one piece.
$5,000?
Oh, yes.
What did they do with it? Did they then...
happy to eat it.
Well, they probably sold it to somebody else for $10,000.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, that's like Peter's chicken with the three legs story.
But, you know, it's wonderful to see that you can actually see the passion that people have for food and use it for a good cause, to donate money for people that are actually hungry.
Now, I was looking for your photographer's name. These photographs are pretty amazing. They make as ethereal as some of your things are, they make everything look magical, these photographs. Was that on purpose?
Yes, photography was a very important point for me in the book. I wanted the picture to be alive. I think there's a lot of cookbooks where you have a lot of static, especially when it comes to pastry. It's difficult to give a feel, to give a movement to something plated. I think I wanted to have fun. I wanted to show that like all of what we do is alive and he has movement and he like it really gives you a different dimension when you look at the book.
I love how you take ordinary things and make them extraordinary. Like I'm looking at these pine cones that are gingerbread instead of men in houses. They're gingerbread pine cones.
The pine cone was a beautiful creation that we launched last year. It is actually was inspired by the holiday season and Christmas. Wanted something with gingerbread, and I thought it would be fun to actually recreate a pine cone. So we have those little, it's a solitary pine cone, about life size, and we get those little petals made of chocolate, very tiny loops of chocolate, and we recreate a pine cone. There's all between 60 and 70 little pieces of chocolate, and it looks exactly like a real-sized pine cone. It takes about half an hour to 45 minutes to make one of them.
Uh-huh.
It's very precise, a very unique piece. It's a piece of art, and it's a beautiful creation.
I want to tell you a quick story, because it'll fit right in with this theme-wise. I can't remember what year it was or why we were there, but we were in Paris for Christmas. And I remember standing in the middle of the Place Madeleine and taking a picture pointing one way towards Etihad with a Christmas tree in every window.
Okay.
And then turning 180 degrees and doing the same thing, taking pictures of Fauchon. and I bet you can remember the feel of that day. I think it was Christmas Day or the day after.
Oh, nice. Maybe I was there in the basement.
You never can tell. Maybe you were there in the basement.
I wonder these things. I mean, you don't have any specific art training, but these are works of art. I mean, look at this. I'm looking at the Baked Alaska. That's gorgeous.
Thank you. I don't have any art training, but I love art. I love painting, sculpture. I love fashion and architecture. I get inspired by art. And it is, I think, like, the first contact you have with food is visual contact. And it has to be seducing. It has to invite you to be willing to try it. And I think that the first contact you have, the visual contact, has to have a good impact. So it has to be pretty, beautiful, yummy.
Well, I mean, even your s'mores, they're fabulous looking. But the stories I love are things like when you were confronted with these new traditions in the United States, like the peeps. I laughed so hard about your peeps.
Well, you know, I grew up in France, so I'm not very familiar with American tradition, but I'm very open-minded. I love learning about tradition here in America, and I always get inspired when I see new things, and I just feel like a kid that is learning, you know. It's great to see different things that you don't know and be able to do something fun with it.
Tell us about, I think this is pretty special, Paris, New York.
So the Paris, New York was a pastry inspired by the Paris Brest. Paris Brest is a French classic. It was created for the Tour de France cycling race. And it's a ring of cream puff filled with a hazelnut cream. So you find it in every bakery in France. I want to bring a French classic, but with a little bit of New York twist and American twist. So I decided to flavor it with peanut flavor of chocolate and caramel, and it's called Paris New York because it's kind of like New York flavor of peanut butter, and it reminds me of the Snickers bar as well.
Yeah, well, that's one of your very first experiences was with a Snicker bar when you arrived. You got through immigration, right?
That's right.
It was your first meal in America, admit it.
So, it was pretty tasty.
You know, let's just back up a little bit and explain how this book is organized. You start out with talking about ideas behind various creations, right?
Yes, that's right. So the book is divided in two. The first half is all the stories and inspiration and what made me do those pastries and why it was popular at the bakery and the story behind my 20 years in the kitchen and what happened in there and the people that I met. It's pretty much a traditional and story-based. And the other half of the book is the recipe section that is divided in three sections. There's three levels for beginners, intermediate, and advanced. And it will give you a chance to do all these recipes at home, so all the recipes are in there. And it was very important for me that I could recreate all the recipes myself at home, so I try all these recipes in my small, tiny kitchen in New York City, and it works. I try to give as much information as I could into what to do, giving tips, and also what to look for to avoid mistakes.
So these are the secret recipes now.
These are the secret recipes. I would suggest everyone to start with a beginner recipes to see how you feel.
Yeah, I was just checking out the Baked Alaska recipe. That's really not on my
The Baked Alaska is definitely an advanced recipe. There's like four different kinds of ice cream and sorbet. So this is one of the recipes you should do last, definitely.
We had interesting aside about Baked Alaska. Last time we were in New Orleans, we had lunch at Antoine's. I guess we should have had dinner at Antoine's, really. And their famous dessert is a Baked Alaska. Somebody came out with a Baked Alaska for us. So we looked around the room to see who didn't have one. And then we made a present. And we exchanged email addresses with the couple from Indiana, I think, who were the proud recipients of the cake. And because I took a picture of them with their Baked Alaska, and I sent it off to them, and they were very pleased.
But the more amazing thing
is I have two cousins in England. They're both engineers. One of them makes Baked Alaska. This is not something you would expect of an engineer, but my cousin Michael Barron makes that for dessert, and I was astounded.
That's great. So hopefully you can have the book and recreate the recipe.
We're not taking this book to him.
No, I might just copy that page, but you haven't mentioned, and Anne hasn't mentioned, the thing that to me about this book is absolutely the most amazing, because it's about how you teach philosophy through baking pastry, and there are two wonderful examples, the quenelle recipe and the madeleine recipe. Perhaps you can explain the philosophical answer that you get as a result of working on these recipes.
You know, there are a lot of things that you need to learn when you bake at home. You have to be very patient, and sometimes there are things you cannot rush. If you do a dough, you have to let it rest. If you mix something and you need resting time, you cannot rush it. You cannot go over it and try to have shortcuts. You have to be disciplined when you bake, and it's all about organization and understanding the recipe as well. Time is a very important factor as well. There are things that you make in the kitchen that have a shelf life of sometimes just a few minutes, like the madeleines, for example. For me, we bake them fresh to order at the bakery. It's only when people come to the counter and order madeleines that we actually pipe them and bake them in the oven. So they're wonderful. They're very beautiful when you eat them fresh, hot from the oven. But it tastes a lot different if you eat them cold. It's not the same experience. And I think experience is a huge factor into remembering pastries and remembering what having memories of food. And I think it's all connected. When you have memories of food, when you eat something and you remember eating it as a child, or it brings you back to a certain place with someone who you care for, it's something that it touches your heart and something that you remember for a long time.
And the quenelles set the
Canelli de Bordeaux, yeah, Canelli.
I'm English, I'm allowed to mispronounce it.
That's all right.
But the answer here is a different one. The answer is, if you cut corners, you will fail.
Exactly. So for a lot of like the recipes in the book, we give very specific details on what to do, what not to do. And sometimes if you try to go faster, well, it will just not work because there's resting time, there's places where temperature is very important, there's places where measuring precisely is very important. But I think people shouldn't be afraid of baking. I think if you have like a minimum of like a scale in the kitchen, thermometers, so sometimes it's easy to make most of the recipe in the book.
Uh-huh. Well, yes. But when you talk about it, you make it into a romantic episode. You're very poetic.
Thank you very much. Yes.
You know Massimo Bottura. He's the Osteria Francescana, and he's the third ranked restaurant in the world for Modena.
Okay.
Anyhow, we just got his book. We talked to him on Monday. Mm-hmm. And he is taking this tack too. His recipes are in the back, and they're in such fine print, you can hardly read them. And mainly, it's all about the ideas, how he got the ideas. And that's kind of what you're doing, too. You're really explaining, amplifying on the creative process, which is a tough job. It's very hard for people who are not creative to appreciate this. But as I said, it's magical. And I just couldn't be happier for you than I am seeing you produce this book. I don't know where you go from here.
That's great. I think that the book was really to inspire people and give them a different way of thinking when it comes to pastry. Just invite everyone to be creative themselves. And sometimes, you know, if you have a recipe that you like from your mom, from your grandma, it doesn't have to be a recipe from the book, but at least it helps you to think differently, give you ideas on how to be creative and how to change things and make it your own. And it is something that I wanted to people to see inside the book.
Here's a forecast, Franz. I think there's another cronut in your future somewhere.
He's already done that.
I don't know when, but I'm sure there's another one and maybe more than one. So thank you so much for sharing your philosophy as well as your secret recipes. You're welcome back anytime you have anything more to add.
Thank you very much, guys.
And when we tell you that Massimo Bottura, our old friend with his first cookbook out, is right after the break, I'm sure you're going to stay with us.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Ta-ta, and here we go, a masterpiece of a cookbook, particularly because it is a perfect reflection of who this man, chef, skilled artisan, he likes to be called rather than artist, and thinker is about. The title is Never Trust a Skinny Italian Chef, which is pretty funny, but Massimo claims he's not that skinny. Massimo Bottura, let's hear how he wrote this book, how long it took, and what you're supposed to expect from it. You really should have it. This is a book long in the making. This is Massimo Bottura, the chef of Osteria Francescana, which is ranked third in the entire world. It's called Never Trust a Skinny Italian Chef.
Oh, my God, I'm not so skinny, eh? Come on.
Oh, you are skinny. But
trust me, please, trust me.
Well, I love this book, and it's been a huge hit. And you were pleased with it, which is something extraordinary from a lot of people I talk to. Authors are usually not as pleased as they should be with their books, but this one is a marvelous book.
Thanks, Anne.
You pointed out that it's not really a cookbook. Could you explain that?
Yeah. Thanks, Anne. Thanks. Why? Because I think in the beginning, my title was No Recipes, but my publisher said, no way you're going to publish a book with no recipes. So I just compressed all the recipe in 25 pages at the end of the book. Because I think the most important thing, like, create recipe is an intellectual act. And the recipe, yes, are okay if you need to know what kind of technique or where to go to get those flavors, but what I really feel it's the creative process that is very important. That's the most important thing, the creative process and the story behind every dish. That it's, you know, cooking is not waking up in the morning, going in the kitchen, chop celery, carrot, onions, and serve it. No, it's not that. It's the chef, a contemporary chef, has to ask himself questions. And the answer to those questions are our plates, our recipes.
Now, you set yourself an interesting task. You are in Italy. You are an Italian chef. You are in Modena, an Italian a region that's very traditional. And yet, you set yourself the task of getting rid of nostalgia and sentimentalism while preserving and evolving, which is the key word, traditions.
Yeah, that's why I divide the book in four chapters. One is tradition in evolution. This is the concept you are expressing right now.
Right.
Because if I look at my past in a nostalgic way, the tradition, they don't evolve. If I'm looking at the past in a critic way and bring to the future just the best part of my past, the traditions are still evolving and keep evolving. That's the most important thing. We need to bring Italy to a new phase, a new stage, you know. We cannot lose ourselves in nostalgia.
Right.
That's a very important thing.
And you work through it with all these recipes, and you explain in each chapter how you are, with each recipe, evolving or bringing the traditions up to date. Now, you said the two most important dishes are the five ages of Parmesan Reggiano and Bollito, not boiled.
Yeah,
now,
not
I've,
boiled.
I've had both of those more than once.
I know.
I can't resist ordering them. Could you explain the five ages of Parmesan, which is a very poetic story?
That's a very important dish. First of all, I start creating that dish in 1994.
Wow.
And I was very concentrated on create a plate with just one ingredient, Parmigiano Reggiano, and serve in texture and temperature. So I was concentrated on technique. Then I met Mr. Panini. He was the owner, because he passed away last year, and he was the owner of Ombre, one of the most important cheese company in Modena. And he had that dish in 98, and he told me at the end of the meal, Massimo, this dish is fantastic, but you have to think about, you to think more deep about the aging process. The aging process is something very important. The aging process is something that is telling you what is our terroir. So it's the slow food. It's the seasons, the autumn, the winter, the cold of the winter, and then the foggy of autumn. And then the very hot summer, and that it's crazy, but it's like that. That's the point. So what I did, I start evolving the aging process and start like experimenting the aging on big wheels of cheese and bring them to 40, 50, 60 months. And I saw the magic of that, the magic of the product. And from that moment, I evolve the plate on the aging process to express what is my terroir,
right.
My area, what is like the heroic part of these artisans, the cheesemakers. They are giving me this amazing cheese, and I'm trying to express and this kind of flavors at their best. That was the plate. And in the beginning, everyone was like really, really looking at me like the one to burn me in the main piazza like a witch, you know. Now they call me maestro. So the point of broken point is there. It's just a line. Avant-garde or contemporary cooking is like that, like contemporary art. It's always like that. It's a very thin line in which if you look on one side, they think you're crazy. If you look on the other side, they think you're a genius. We just have to live our lives like that. It's fine. It's okay. We love it.
Yeah.
That's it.
How about running us through the other important dish, most important.
Yeah, the bolito no boil.
Yes, exactly. Which I love.
When I said before, the contemporary chef has to go in the kitchen and ask ourselves question. I mean, that day I asked this question: does the tradition really respect the ingredients? And why do I have to boil the meat into the water? Because 1,000 of years of history told me that. That was the point. Bolito misto is one of the most and the most classic preparation of north of Italy. And people are boiling the meat since 13th century.
Right.
But they were boiling the meat because they didn't have anything. So this meat was boiled, and they were using the broth on one side and the meat on the other side. They didn't care about vitamin, protein, organoleptic parts. Who cares about that? They just have to survive and eat what they had. So I spoke with Professor Montanari, and he told me the whole genesis of this. And from that moment, I said, no way I'm going to boil the meat into the water. No way I'm going to ruin this fantastic meat that comes from the Alps, and they're like incredibly flavor, and with the back taste of herbs or wild things, and I say no way, and from that moment I create the bolito not boiled. But in the beginning, for the five different age Parmigiano, they were laughing on me, but 10 years later, the five different age of Parmigiano has been declared like the plate of the decade for Italian gastronomy. And the bolito misto, now they are teaching how to prepare it at the university.
Oh, so, are they really?
Yeah, they're really now in Parma.
Oh, that's fabulous. That's great.
They came, they watched the whole process, they put everything vacuum-packed back to the laboratory in Parma, they study everything, and they realize I was right. So it's the ethic way to approach to tradition. So the answer... does the tradition really respect the ingredients? The answer was no. So it's my, I have to do that because I have to do it because it's in my heart, in my soul, and I have to help tradition to evolve.
Well, you've been sort of skirting around it, but I'm going to get to the point here where you said if there's any dish in your cuisine repertoire that's a self-portrait, it's the eel swimming up the Po River.
Yeah.
Well, you're talking about that now.
No, that's my self-portrait. Is the eel swimming up the Po River. You know, it's like the eel. It's swimming up because it's
brilliant.
It's like avant-garde is like that. You just go on the opposite direction where everyone is like, if everyone looks at on the right side, you have to look on the left side. The answer is always there.
Yeah.
Answer is always there. You just, I said, okay, this eel is a historic photograph of the Senzi family. In 1596-98, they moved the capital from Ferrara to Modena. Uh-huh. So it was a time for the canal. From Modena, you could arrive by boat on Venice through the canals. And the Senzi family, they lost the incoming of the fishing of the eel because the Pope said we want the incoming back. So they lost the incoming, and they were broke. And so they moved the capital from Ferrara to Modena. And that's the historic photograph. So in my imaginary idea, in mental palette, I'm moving from Comacchio, is a classic place on a delta of the Po River, and the eel is swimming up the Po, the river, and pass through Veneto, and this eel find the polenta. So on the side of, as a side dish, there's a polenta. But it's not a normal polenta. It's like a toasted flour. Then we create a creamy polenta that is kind of creamy, but also toasted. So you have the flavor of the roasted polenta. And then going up, swimming up, you arrive in Mantova. Mantova is the place for mele campanine. There's a small wild apple full of acidity and sweetness. So we concentrate, vacuum pack this acidity, this juice, and come up this incredible acidity flavor of apple. So instead of using the tomato as everyone is using now,
right.
I'm thinking about the 16th century and what they were using as acidity. And this apple was fantastic. Then the eel moved down to Modena, through Modena, and passed in the country of Modena. There is this eel meets the Saba sauce. The Saba sauce is the extract of the mustard that we use to create balsamic vinegar. And arriving in Modena, in the canal of Modena, all the mud. What we did?
Right.
To recreate the mud, we burn celery, onion, and carrots with some fresh herbs in the oven. We powder it, and we create this mud of aromatic mud. But in Canal Chiaro, like the clear canal, Canal Chiaro, where Osteria Francescana is like the eel came up in a Osteria Francescana. And the eel became lacquered with saba, the burned onions, creamy polenta, and extraction of mela campanina.
You know, when we were there last, there was another table in the small room, and you came out after talking to them a little frustrated. You said, they don't understand a thing. My question is, how many of your dining guests actually understand all the thought that goes into these dishes?
No, I have to say that this is a very, very good period for like chefs. And, you know, there is an incredible gastronomic tourism that is coming up. And there are people now from all over the world. They're like moving from one place to another, deciding before where to go to eat. And maybe planning the trip on restaurants.
We do that.
So it's like when they arrive, they know everything. Know everything about you, they know everything about plates, what they want to eat, the region, the ingredients, the tradition, the expressions. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's an amazing period, exciting. And then we are all more free to express ourselves. This is another thing that is very, very good. It's very important.
Well, now, you were talking earlier, before we went on air, about how you are different from an artist, even though you're highly influenced by art. And I was wondering, I view your food as conceptual food. What would be the difference between conceptual art and conceptual food?
Well, I think an artist is free to express himself with total freedom, and so I think it's freedom. And a chef cannot express himself, because I cannot serve bad food. I have to serve good food. This is something that is not giving me freedom to express myself. I have to do good food. Do you understand the concept?
You have
to. It's very thin, but is very clear.
And it has to be flavor.
We are very, very important artisan. In some expression in which concepts meets the word good, means we can get very close to artists, but usually it's not like that.
Well, now you said, and I wonder, do you really believe that chefs are here to make the world more humane and delicious?
Yeah, this is totally right. Actually, I'm like so involved in all this project to show everyone what we can do with our spotlight, or our knowledge, our sense of responsibility. And at the Universal Exposition of Milan of next year, we're going to do a pavilion in which all the best chefs in the world, they're going to come and they're going to cook the leftover. Actually, I have to say that Carlin Petrini stole this idea, and the whole project of Salone del Gusto was about leftover, and was about work with the leftover, that, you know, the relation from FAO, in which they say that 1.3 billion of tons, billion tons of food are thrown away every year.
Yes.
This is insane.
Exactly.
Insane. So what are we going to do? We're going to cook leftover bread. And we're going to show that we are not rock star. We are just human beings.
I love that.
And we really care about the future. And we want to teach, as an example, all these young kids that are going to come for lunch, what is the example? The example of humility. The example of not throwing away everything. The example of our past, where we come from.
Oh, that's fabulous. That's really good to hear,
Thank
too.
You.
Now, back to the book.
It's going to be great.
You organize it into certain chapters, and I've seen that you break out some chapters for different presentations because you're everywhere on stage anymore. One of them is Come to Italy with Me, The Journey. Which
is great.
It's fabulous.
It was a huge undertaking.
It's
about the first chapter is that the second chapter is working class heroes.
Yes.
You know, my passion for the music and John Lennon and humility of a sardine or like a crust of Parmigiano Reggiano. The third one is my relation with art, and the fourth one is Come to Italy with Me. When the sense of responsibility comes from the knowledge and consciousness, you have this sense of responsibility is growing inside you and is telling you that you have to do something, especially for a country like Italy that has a very, very deep crisis that is not just economic crisis, but I think is an identity crisis. So what I thought to create a menu to make everyone fall in love for our country again. Starting from wind of Pantelleria, that is bringing salty wind on the capers and create this incredible product or in quality. Or the almond from Noto, from the anchovies of the Amalfi Coast, or the red shrimp from Sanremo, or the foggy porch of Bologna. And this is magic. This is a magic country, and we need to do something. And thinking about JFK, you know, think about what you can do for your country, not what your country can do for you. We create Come to Italy with Me.
Well, it's a beautiful chapter. And referencing
Thanks.
This book, I think that it's interesting that you have these startling photographs laying out either techniques or ingredients in the recipes that follow. Then you have an explanation of the creative process and what the significance of the dish is. And I think that the bio that you included was very helpful as well, which is and it's good to have.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the recipes themselves, all the way in the back, in such fine print that I can barely read them. But you don't really expect anyone to cook
I like
it.
That. I like that. I use that really small font for a purpose.
Yeah,
who cares about the recipe?
Exactly. I think it's so you, and it's such a wonderful book, and it's such a contribution. It's intelligent. It's literary. It's both lyrical and rational, as you are. And I think that I hope this is a huge success. Now, I've dominated the conversation. Peter wants to say something.
Of course you have. I want to get you started in a new direction because I know you like new directions. So
I always like new directions.
So just a moment ago, you referenced John Kennedy saying, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I'm going to give you another quote, and I'm going to ask you ask you if you'll dedicate some of the next 10 years to that. And the origin is George Bernard Shaw, although it was paraphrased by Bobby Kennedy. Some men see things that are and ask why. I see things that never were and ask why not.
Oh, that's very good.
Isn't that good?
That's very good.
I think you can do a cookbook.
And that's why, Peter, that's why I need, it's inside me, and I will work to help schools, to help the young and students. We need that. We need culture right now. We need to start again from culture. If you don't have culture, you don't go anywhere. You know, do you understand what I mean?
Oh, yes.
It's like, it's so important. And all this young generation, their generation, they know through internet, they know nothing about everything.
Yes.
And I want to rediscover the pleasure to touch a book, to touch the paper, to feel that. If they don't get lost in front of a computer and they start again to feel passion, that's what is going to be the future. It's going to be about that, and I'm going to fight for that, you know?
And that's your next book.
Yeah, exactly. Starting from there. Starting from there.
Massimo, thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Anne.
It's
always a great pleasure to talk to you guys.
Hope to see you soon.
Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
And we'll be here again, same time, same place next week. We hope you'll join us then. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.